First case for argument this morning is Harkins et al. Versus Riverboat Services. Mr. Raffaello.
Good morning. May it please the court. This case arose in January 1999 as a suit by 13 crew members from the Marine Department of Harris East Chicago, Indiana gambling boat to claim overtime wages for the 16 hours each week that they worked over 40 during the time employed. The vessel called the motor vessel Showboat was manned by a master who was the defendant of the appellee in this case, Riverboat Services Incorporated. The plaintiff alleged in the suit that under the Department of Regulations, Labor Department regulations, namely 29 CFR 783.31, that they were not, open quote, employed as, close quote, seamen for purposes of their wage payments. Their employer, on the other hand, contended that they were exempt from overtime. Within a month after the suit was filed, approximately 13 more plaintiffs had joined the suit, and upon the defendant learning of the additional plaintiffs, 13 of the named plaintiffs who were then currently employed or on seasonal layoff were discharged, allegedly for bringing this suit. Section 215A3 of the Fair Labor Standards Act makes it a prohibited act to discharge or otherwise discriminate against any employee who has filed a suit or asserted their rights under the act. There was direct evidence at trial from three sources that from the plaintiffs that the fact of joining the suit was the reason for their firing. After nearly 3.5 years of discovery, depositions, and two motions for summary judgment, the district court, about 4 weeks before the first set trial date, granted summary judgment to Harris Casino, which the appellee here joined, and dismissed with prejudice 18 of the 21 remaining co-plaintiffs. On the ground that the statute of limitations had expired as to their claims, notwithstanding the fact that they had actively participated in the litigation for fully 3.5 years, had sat for their depositions, and actually filed written affidavits as part of the record in opposition to those motions for summary judgment.
Have they now all filed the consents that the statute requires?
No.
Well, why not?
It was deemed too late as of the entry of the summary judgment.
Well, I know, but wouldn't it be good to have those in the record so we would know that these people did, in fact, want to be part of the suit?
Well, I agree. It would be nice if we had the discrete piece of paper that says, I hereby consent to join this suit. However, we did not believe that was necessary in light of Anderson versus Montgomery Ward, which this court decided, I believe virtually squarely on point, that a plaintiff who is named a party in the caption of the suit or in the body of the pleading is deemed to consent to the action. That's the first thing. So therefore,
of course, he might be named without his even knowing it. Let me ask you a different question. These 18 people who were dismissed, are the facts bearing on their, you know, status as seamen different from that of the three people who went to trial?
No.
So does it really make, what difference does it make that, I mean, I can see, of course, why you want to get them back into the suit and so on, but from the standpoint of the adequacy of the trial to develop the facts, does their exclusion matter?
Does their exclusion matter?
From the trial. I mean, if the facts concerning them are the same as the facts concerning the three, then the fact that they weren't in the trial wouldn't alter the record.
Well, they were in the trial. They were.
Oh, you're right.
For the discharge case. See, that's the.
I see. Is this the retaliation that they were?
No, they were dismissed out from the overtime.
Well, what did you mean in the sense that they were in the trial? They were in the trial with regard to the retaliation.
They were in the,
but not with regard to their seamen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the jury came back with a question: Why aren't these 14 people claiming overtime? Now we felt that by the district judge throwing out the overtime aspect of the case when it came time to go to trial. And you know the irony here is that that these same people who were dismissed, at least most of them, 14 of them, had discharge cases. So it's paradoxical that they had consented to join the suit for purposes of being discharged, but not consented for purposes of claiming their overtime. We think the district judge gave a hyper-technical, too strict and too harsh interpretation of Section 216B, which requires a consent in writing filed with the clerk. Under the cases, and I cite quite a few of them in my reply brief as well as my opening brief, any writing would be sufficient to show consent. In fact, there's one case, it's a New York case, Southern District of New York, or Eastern District, Peel's Beer Company, where the judge felt these people had actively participated in the litigation for 3 years. I deem the consent in writing is not necessary. Their active participation in the litigation for 3 years would be sufficient consent for purposes of the statute. The reason for the rule of law is so that the employer knows who is in the suit and who is not. In this case, that reason has been fully satisfied. Every one of these dismissed plaintiffs had given a deposition. Everyone had filed an affidavit in opposition to a motion for summary judgment. There was no doubt in anybody's mind that they had consented to join the suit.
Now, since you named all of the members of this collective action complaint, didn't you?
Right.
You listed them all, yeah.
They're all in.
Why did you call it a collective action? Why not just an old-fashioned lawsuit in which a number of plaintiffs are joined?
Well,
then you wouldn't have your problem.
You know, you're right, 100%. I agree 100%, and I try to make that argument in the district court. It was never really intended. Well, I'll put it this way. The caption of the pleading was never styled as a spurious class action, you know, Woods versus New York Life Insurance. It was never. There was, like, one line in there that said that we were bringing the action on behalf of others. Now, my intent was eventually to get a list of all the employees who were in there to invite them to join the suit in accordance with Woods versus New York Life. We never got that far. So I tried to make the argument that the pleadings could have been construed as individual actions under Rule 20. The district judge apparently didn't buy that. So the reason for the rule has been satisfied. The defendant actually knew who was in the suit. They had taken their depositions. They had written affidavits from them. They were named in the pleadings, and they were named in the body of the suit. Under this court's precedent in Anderson versus Montgomery Ward, the Supreme Court's precedent in Hoffman LaRoche, they should have been deemed to have consented to the suit. Now, the issues in this case are threefold. One, whether the district judge mistakenly did not follow Anderson on the ground of the statute of limitations. Secondly, another collateral issue is whether the doctrine of latches would have protected the plaintiff. The four corners of the complaint show that the claim is cognizable in admiralty. This is clearly a seeming suit for wages. Under maritime law, statutes of limitations are not strictly enforced. Instead, the doctrine of latches applies, and the burden is on the defendant to show unreasonable delay, number one, and two, that the unreasonable delay prejudiced them such as to prevent them from making an efficacious defense. That was never pleaded. The next issue in the case is whether the defendant bore the burden of proof.
But you never designated this as an admiralty suit, did you?
Not per se. But as I read this court's precedent in Wingertner versus Chester Quarry, which I think came out two or three years ago, within the last couple of years, the four corners of that complaint are cognizable in admiralty. There's no doubt about it. It's against the complaint shows that the plaintiffs worked aboard a vessel. They were members of the Marine Department of the crew, and therefore, liberally or broadly construing the pleadings to...
you feel the defendants were obliged to defend this in part as an admiralty case, then?
They could have. I don't say that they were obliged to. From my perception of the pleadings, there was never any doubt that this lawsuit was timely filed. I mean, you know, Harris Casino started gambling in 1997. The Labor Department went in there in 98, found they had $120,000 in overtime due. The Labor Department, unfortunately, couldn't do anything for the plaintiffs, so they came to my office, and we filed a suit January 2nd or 3rd of 1999. So we were well within the 2 or 3 years at most for filing the suit. What happened here was, I believe, a hyper-technicality, which is not what the remedial purposes of the Fair Labor Standards Act intends. The next point I'd like to make is that employed as a seaman, very important. The regulation is crystal clear. To be just because somebody works on a boat or is part of a maritime crew does not mean, for purposes of their wage payment, that they are employed as a seaman. 783.31, 29 CFR 783.31 said, for the employer to get the exemption for a seaman status, the employee must be employed aboard a vessel and render services in aid of the operation of a vessel primarily as a means of transportation. The clear and unequivocal evidence in this case was that boat never moved almost 91% of the time.
Well, okay, so what is the test you would use for a seaman under the Fair Labor Standards Act?
The test I would use is the one that you can find in Owens versus Sea River Maritime, Donovan versus Necton, and Dole versus Petroleum Treaters. Three cases which say that for purposes of wage payments under the Fair Labor Standards Act, seaman, which is a term of art as the Supreme Court has defined in Wylander versus McDermott International, seaman is a maritime term of art to be interpreted in the context of the statute in which it is used. Under the Jones Act,
what is the test you want us to use?
The test I want you to use is the very, very narrowest test possible, found in 783.31.
What is it?
That number one, to qualify for the exemption, the vessel must be in transportation most of the time. Now, a vessel which doesn't move 91% of the time is not primarily in transportation.
I mean, more. It has to be more than 50%.
It's got to be more than 80%. No, it's got to be more than 80%.
More than 80%?
80%.
But you have a lot of boats that can be laid up for a long time that don't go during the winter or something like that, don't you?
Well, that may be true. And during those periods, you have to pay the crew overtime.
But the owner might not even know in advance how much time the ship was actually going to be at sea. You know, if they have repairs, they have to scrape the barnacles.
That's very true, but the law says that if the vessel is not primarily used as a means of transportation...
I think, for example, my impression is that many Navy vessels spend two-thirds of the time in dock, a third with kind of normal maintenance, and then a third with serious overhauls. So there may be, you know, classes of what everybody regards as ships that do not spend more than 50% of the time actually sailing.
That's true. However, in those circumstances, or in most of those circumstances, my research has shown, there are either one, shipping articles, or a union contract, or a government contract, which makes provision for the payment of overtime. In this case, this was a new casino gambling boat. There was no union in there. There were no shipping articles. There was no contract between the master of the vessel and the vessel owner for the payment of overtime wages. Therefore, we have to look to federal law to see what standard applies for purposes of overtime wages.
So you think it's irrelevant what duties a person performs?
No, it's not irrelevant. It's not irrelevant. But first of all, if the boat never moves 90% of the time, there's no way that the employer can get by the first hurdle of the regulation. That's number one. Number two, the three plaintiffs who did go to trial on the seaman exemption all said that they spent over 90-95% of their time doing general housekeeping chores.
Yeah, but I appreciate that your first point, Mr. Rothfeld. But that second one, if we look at those cases you ask us to look at, you know, Owens and,
right,
and Donovan, you know, the cook and the maintenance crew fall under, you know, the people that just clean up fall under seaman status. I mean, if we go to a factual comparison.
Well, maybe under the facts that they did in that case.
Yeah,
but here, that boat never moved 91%.
Well, you want us to really get to the fiction of these, or pierce the fiction of these gambling boats that really are labeled boats, but don't transport for any.
Well, it's really not a fiction. I mean, the fact.
Well, they are boats. But
they are boats, that's true. And we have the ship's log, Joint Exhibit 1, show that the boat, never moved. I mean, they may be seamen, there are seamen de jure and seamen de facto. They may be seamen de facto, but they're not seamen de jure for purposes of their wage payments. Now, the burden is on the employer to prove the affirmative defense of exemption. And exemptions are strictly and narrowly construed against the employer.
What do you think the purpose of the exemption is?
The purpose of the exemption is to only protect employers who are, in this context, who operate vessels that are in motion most of the time.
Why?
For the purpose of not interfering with interstate commerce.
I don't understand.
Well, there's a case I cite in here. It's Cruz versus Chesapeake that has something.
The FLSA applies to workers in interstate commerce. I don't understand.
It applies to who?
It applies to workers employed in interstate commerce.
Right, it does.
So why do you think they carved this exception for seamen?
Well, probably to not burden employers with having to pay overtime when the vessel is away from port, and it also takes into account when the vessel's away from port that the crew sleeps on the vessel, they eat their meals on the vessel, they're there all the time. In this case, everybody went home. They were like factory workers.
Well, that gets back to, I think, my earlier point. It's the uniqueness of being a seaman that it's sort of a 24/7 when you're literally involved in
exactly
seamanship.
Right.
So isn't your argument that there really is no seamanship connected with work upon these kinds of vessels?
Actually, there wasn't. Right. There's virtually none. I mean, one of the plaintiffs testified she cleaned toilets, cleaned ceiling tiles, changed light bulbs, dirty ashtrays.
Well, that a seaman can do. And that's why I say the fact of either Donovan or Owen speaks to, maintenance can be the responsibility, obviously, of seamen on a vessel.
It can be, right, if the vessel is used primarily as a means of transportation. That's the test. In this case, it is clear that boat was moored 91% of the time. The ship's logs show it. I believe that the point that the defendant couldn't get past that first hurdle. Secondly, under the duties test, there was no substantial substantive evidence from the defendant to discredit or to disprove any of the testimony they gave about what they actually did while the vessel was moored. Every one of these plaintiffs went home at night. They worked 8 or 12 hours a day, whatever it was, and they could have done the same thing on land. And they should have gotten paid overtime.
What deference, if any, should we pay to Indiana law, which requires that it be a serviceable and ready to go afloat? And I mean, Indiana requires that
right.
It has its capacity. So you're saying we don't look to the capacity; we have to look to actual time away from the dock.
Right, you do. Under the Indiana Gaming Commission regulations, the vessel was gambling was only permitted when the vessel was underway. Now, we know that the vessel was tied up for nearly 2 years because of the life rafts and life jackets and problems like that. The vessel also couldn't go out usually between about November and April or May because of the weather. If the water conditions, I think my time is up.
No, not until it becomes red.
Oh, okay.
But you're getting close.
All right, okay. The vessel couldn't go out if the water temperature was below 38 degrees. They couldn't go out if the waves were 2 feet high. It couldn't go out if harbor conditions or harbor traffic was heavy. It couldn't go out if the weather was below such a certain temperature. There are a lot of restrictions.
Mr. Rocha, I just want to remind you didn't reserve any time for rebuttal.
I did. I reserved 8 minutes.
Am I still right? You can't do that.
Well, it wasn't. Who'd you inform of the 8 minutes?
We called in the... I saw it on the sheet when I came in.
Oh, you're quite late. When I do your interview...
All right, I think you... Well, if there's an absolute urgent rebuttal necessary, I'll consider it.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Mr. Costello. Ms. Mannix.
May it please the Court. Your Honor, you've asked some very pertinent questions here this morning, and I'd like to address some of them right now. Mr. Rossiello has spoken about written affidavits being filed in this matter and that satisfied the written consent filing. First, I want to reiterate what we did spell out in our brief, and that is Mr. Rossiello never raised in the trial court that any writing or an affidavit or anything could constitute consent in writing. He argued very strenuously only that Anderson controlled and that there is no requirement for a consent in writing if the plaintiff is named in a collective action in the complaint in the
Ms. Mannix, when did in the course of the litigation did the issue arise of the failure to have these affidavits? How deep were the parties into this litigation?
Your Honor, on March 22nd in the year 2000, I raised before Magistrate Judge Denlow the issue of consent not being filed in this case.
And have depositions been taken at that point? Any depositions?
Your Honor, I don't believe any deposition had been taken at that point. We were doing discovery. We were in the midst of discovery of some payroll records. I expressed a concern about what plaintiffs were in the case and what plaintiffs were out of the case. Because, as the testimony came out at trial, there were some plaintiffs that had been added into the complaint caption without their knowledge or consent, and they had later dropped out of the lawsuit. We had other plaintiffs dropping out of the lawsuit. As we pointed out in our brief, Mr. Rossiello added Captain Larry Prezette, who was also a witness at the trial, to another wage claim case, Superson, and he added a witness in this trial, Lisa Medrano, to another wage claim case, both without their knowledge or consent. We raised early on the issue of written consent. Mr. Rossiello expressed to Magistrate Judge Denlow at that hearing on March 22nd that, yes, this is a collective action, not a typical class action, but a spurious class action under this court's decision in Wood, and that he had the consents, had been giving them to me, and would have them on file. So really, very early on...
Was there a date set for you to receive those? And what transpired? I want to know, was the representation made that you would have them, or Mr. Rossiello was directed to file them? What happened at that point?
The representation was made that he was giving them to me, and they would be filed. That was not a problem, that they were back at his office. They were not filed.
And there was no follow-up action before Magistrate Denlow on this particular issue?
No, Your Honor, and Magistrate Judge Denlow at that proceeding did invite Mr. Rossiello to come back if there was an issue with the consents to see if that could be worked out. Mr. Rossiello never did come back with those consents. As this court knows, the FLSA requires written consents when it's a collective action, and the statute of limitations under a collective action tolls once the written consents are filed. So there are two arguments on that. There's a waiver in the lower court. He never argued that any writing would be one. There are no written affidavits. I believe what Mr. Rossiello was referring to might be verifications of answers to interrogatories, or maybe a request to admit, but there were no written affidavits filed in this case in the motion for summary judgment. Your Honor, you asked a very pertinent question on does exclusion really matter here? And really it doesn't, because the plaintiff stipulated at trial that their duties and responsibilities on board this vessel were dictated by Defendant's Exhibit 234, which sets out the duties and responsibilities of Firewatch.
Mr. Rossiello's concern is that the jury was confused because you had 14 of these 18 who had overtime, who were identically situated with the other three who were allowed to litigate their overtime claims, but they didn't have overtime claims, and the jury wondered why, since they were identical, why they didn't have overtime claims.
I understand that he has raised that issue, Your Honor, but I believe that's a red herring. If the jury had come back in favor of the plaintiffs that had filed overtime claims and retaliation claims,
yes, no, but I don't think that's what he's saying. He's saying is the jury is told three people are complaining they didn't get overtime, 14 other people identically situated apparently aren't claiming overtime, and so doesn't that make it sound as if this overtime claim is kind of spurious? Most people who in this class don't press such a claim. That's what he's worried about.
Well, Your Honor, I believe the evidence at trial showed that the crew rotation on board the motor vessel Showboat, or MV Windstar, was way more than the 21 or 18 plaintiffs here. In fact, it was over 100 people were employed.
No, but I'm sure a jury could understand how, even though they had only, say, three plaintiffs, there might be hundreds of other people with similar claims. They don't expect to encounter them all in the same suit. But when they have these other 14 people in the same suit pressing another claim against the same employer, they would wonder. And then wouldn't they also wonder what would be the basis for retaliation claims of these 14? If they didn't have overtime claims, since the retaliation that's alleged is retaliation for claiming overtime.
Your Honor,
wouldn't the jury just be thoroughly muddled by all this?
Your Honor, it came out during the trial that all of the named plaintiffs had brought overtime claims against the defendant, Riverboat Services. It was brought out that they had filed those claims in January and February. It was brought out in trial testimony that they were discharged after bringing those claims. And Mr. Rossiello did quite extensively examine our witnesses on that aspect.
But then what was the jury told about what had happened to, I mean, that's certainly a good point that you make, but what was the jury, I forgot now, what was the jury told about the 14? Why? What had happened to their claims?
The jury was told that they were not to concern themselves about those claims, that those claims had previously been resolved.
Resolved. So settled, presumably, or that's what they think, has been settled. Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
On the issue of why does exclusion matter, I believe that's a very pertinent question here because, as a matter of fact, each one of the overtime plaintiffs had the exact same duties and responsibilities on board the motor vessel Showboat as the other one. So if this court deems that the three who presented their evidence were employed as seamen within the exemption, then there really is no harm for the 18 that were dismissed out on summary judgment. Mr. Rossiello also made the statement here this morning that he tried to make the argument that this was not a collective action, that it was an independent action on behalf of each of these independent plaintiffs, and that the district court didn't buy it. I don't believe the record reflects any of those arguments ever being made in the district court. This is, I believe, the first time he's made that argument. Mr. Rossiello also made the argument regarding laches and that this is an admiralty suit. And Judge, you asked a very quick question on that. And Mr. Rossiello said we could have defended this as an admiralty action. As a matter of fact, Mr. Rossiello did attempt to amend his complaint after the motion for summary judgment had been denied and reconsideration had been denied twice. He attempted to amend the complaint to add an admiralty claim under Rule 9H.
How could there be an admiralty claim for overtime wage? I don't understand.
Your Honor, we didn't understand it either, and Magistrate Denlow denied it, saying that this is an FLSA claim. This is not an admiralty claim for wages due for regular working hours. As this court knows, if it was an admiralty suit, the jury demand would have been stricken and this case would not have gone to the jury. The defendants did argue to strike the jury demand. Judge Denlow denied it, saying this is not a case in admiralty, this is an FLSA case. Finally, Your Honor, Mr. Rossiello spent a great deal of time arguing about when the ship is docked and when it's in transportation. I believe the plaintiffs have admitted in their reply brief that this was a vessel in navigation at all times. It was always unnavigable.
Well, I know, but there's an air of unreality, it seems to me, to this notion. That, I mean, forget the duties. I agree the duties are completely irrelevant. You know, if you're on the Queen Mary or something, most of the crew are waiters and so on, so ladling soup or something, they're not doing anything distinctively maritime. But isn't the point that, and Chief Judge Flom mentioned this, that when the ship is at sea day after day, you know, it's understood people are going to be working irregular hours and it's awkward to require overtime and so on. But if you have a ship that only spends a tiny amount of time at sea, then there really isn't any, then the purpose of the exemption doesn't really fit the circumstances.
Your Honor,
I mean, what congressional purpose is served by exempting these people from, exempting the company from overtime obligation?
The exemption, Your Honor, is for seamen, and you asked that question earlier of Mr. Rossiello as to the purpose and why this seamen exemption came into the FLSA. And it came in because the seamen themselves lobbied for it. They have separate and distinct benefits that they get when they are at sea. They have separate and distinct benefits they get as maintenance and cure. And so under the Jones Act and under other benefits that are primarily for seamen, seamen lobbied for this exemption under the FLSA so that those benefits would not be tainted.
Are these people, do they have maintenance and cure rights?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely.
What is cure? Is that medical?
Yes, Your Honor. We have to pay for their wages.
The next question he asked, cure is unique as far as I can tell the Admiralty law, and it has to do with total care, hospitalization, everything else.
That's correct.
When I first encountered it, I suppose, or I assumed that they were talking about some medical intervention would promise to cure somebody of whatever ailed them, and I found that I was dead wrong. It means care, essentially.
That's right, Your Honor. It means we have to pay for all health benefits. If they're stranded somewhere, we have to pay for maintenance and daily wages. So it is a very healthy benefit to the seamen to have that. And they lobbied for this exemption under the FLSA.
Maintenance?
And cure.
The maintenance part is, you say wages.
Wages.
If they can't work, there's...
That's correct. There's also some other benefits regarding if they're taken off a vessel when they're not at their home port. There's some other benefits that do accrue. I don't believe any of those would come into play here. As Your Honor knows, the case law is very specific that it makes no difference if the vessel is moored or if the vessel is actually underway for the seaman exemption to apply. The cases of Walling versus Kingsburg, going back to 1947, stated that even though the engines and boilers were disassembled on board the vessel, so the vessel could not even move, they were still exempt as seamen because of the duties they carried out and how they were employed. Here, Your Honor, this vessel had to be ready to be underway at any time. It's a 3,150 horsepower vessel. It's 2,802 gross tons, and it carried 4,250 people.
But that has nothing to do with your argument, right? If it weighed 10 tons and carried 3 gerbils, it would still be... You would still argue that it was that they were seamen, not the gerbils, but the people running the boat.
Yes, Your Honor, I would. I would still argue that, and I would still emphasize that one of the main reasons for this vessel, for the duties of the people on board the vessel and the Marine crew, were for the safety of the vessel. And with that amount of people on board, they had to be vigilant at all times regarding the safety of the passengers and the crew. So, Your Honor, as to the section of the exemption that says you must be employed as seamen, regardless of whether it's moored or not, they were always employed as seamen. Mr. Rossiello also brought up that the plaintiffs did not engage in any seamanship and that there was no evidence presented at trial to disprove what the plaintiffs said that they did, which was housekeeping duties. I believe Your Honors have already addressed their duties as being seamen's duties. However, as for seamanship, if you just look at Defendant's Exhibit 234, which was stipulated to by the plaintiffs, that shows that indeed their duties and obligations were all seamanship.
Yeah, but you have about 20 people involved in navigation here, if you're generous. Is that right, Ms. Manning?
Your Honor, we...
I'm talking about seamen now. And normally, you've got a vessel that has the potential to carry 3,000, 4,000 people. You're not working with 20 people involved in navigation. And I'm including the firemen and everybody else. I mean, why legislatures deem it important to create these venues, it's not for me to decide, but I suppose, reflect upon. But it is troublesome that we've got the substantial number of employees working here who really have nothing to do with navigation, and such a minuscule amount of time and a minuscule amount of number of people involved in the operation of this boat. I mean, if this boat were really out there, 91% versus 9, you couldn't operate it, I don't think, with 20 folks. Maybe you could. I don't know.
Your Honor, the certificate of inspection dictates who has to man the vessel, the master, the crew, and that does say that for all voyages, no matter if it's 2 feet, 2 miles, 4 miles, for all voyages, that has to be the crew. And it was manned with that crew at all times. Otherwise, it could not take on passengers to begin with.
Why are these casinos on boats?
Because the state makes them for serve on boats. It's the only way they give them a license. The theory is that you're going back to the Mississippi River of gambling.
Right. They have to be in navigation.
But that's a state fiction tool. They don't have slot machines in the churches is what it amounts to. I don't know why not, but there you are.
I'm sorry.
This is a state judgment, Indiana and so on,
yep.
Illinois.
Right.
Yes,
it's not a federal requirement.
No, Your Honor. There's not a federal requirement regarding these vessels. It is only the Indiana State Gaming Commission that has made the requirement that these vessels must be in navigation and must group.
Did they give a reason for it, or is it... Is there a stated reason as opposed to whatever the real...
The stated reason, Your Honor, is they want them to cruise on Lake Michigan so they're not actually on Indiana soil, but because they're on the Great Lakes.
Uh-huh.
So it's not actually in the state of Indiana.
Society from gambling on land?
That's it, Your Honor.
In Illinois, they have them. Elgin, Illinois, and the Fox River, they have them in Joliet, Illinois, and the Illinois River, they have the Mississippi River. Anything that's navigable, scream. I don't know why they don't have them at Salt Creek. That's an Elmhurst. They don't. It's a shame. I think we ought to get one.
But is there gambling while the boat is docked?
Yes, Your Honor. There is gambling while the vessel is docked, while it's moored. And there's gambling when it's away from the moor. And, in fact, I think the owner would like to have it sail much more than be docked so that the patrons would not be able to exit the facilities as readily as they could when it's moored.
Well, it's revenue generating. I suppose the state has an interest in maximizing its take.
There are any more questions?
Apparently not. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
How much time did Mr. Rossiello have left? 30 seconds. You may have 2 minutes, Mr. Rossiello.
Judge, I would just like to say, first of all, there is something in the record in one of my motions for reconsideration before Judge Hibbler to ask him to construe the pleadings as individual actions.
Before I get too far into that, let me ask a question. Did you say that you had affidavits that they from your people that were in your office that you would give to her and to the court showing her admission consent of the case?
I said that I had consent from most of them. I knew I had written fee agreements from everybody.
Did you say to the court and to your opponent that you had the affidavits that they wanted, and they were part of the case, and you would deliver them to her and the court, and you did that? That's kind of a simple question.
It is, Judge. I did file three consents. For the three that I
want to go back and try one more time. Did you represent to the court and to your opponent that you had written consents that you would file with the court and deliver to the counsel?
I did say something to that effect. Yes, I did.
So the answer is yes.
The answer is yes.
Okay.
But I don't. The three
you
that
don't
I
actually have the consent.
I do have some of them.
Some of them, but you don't have all of them.
I don't have all. I had written fee agreements with everybody, and I've done many of these cases, and every other judge in this district that I've had this issue with has followed Anderson versus Montgomery Ward. This is the first time I've ever had this problem where somebody named in the pleading was deemed not a party unless there was a formal consent filed. Judge Plunkett decided the case, one of my cases, exactly the opposite way. Schwarzberger, it's in there. Now, I did file the three for Williams, Hill, and somebody else. They're in the record. I don't remember if I filed those after I told Magistrate Denlow that I would file them or before. I don't remember that. But I had written fee agreements with everybody. And another thing I'd just like to mention, Judge Denlow did say something on the record to the jury about why the other people were not claiming overtime. Now, I don't remember exactly what he said, but I don't remember him saying that the issue was resolved. I think he just said to the jury that they're not to consider it, that it's not part of the case.
I'm going to have to ask you, Mr. Ashill, to make a final.
All right, and finally, I have no quarrel whatsoever with the duties of the plaintiffs as listed in that exhibit, or the senior's duties. However, that, even though I concede 100%, they did not perform those duties but 5 to 10% of the time at most. And so under the duties test, the defendant has not met its burden of proof because the plaintiff spent well over 80% of their time doing non-senior's work.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ashill. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will take a short recess.
I think that's positive on calendar they took in. Mm-hmm.
deputies all the time. But what time can you write the deputies on this one?
Thank you.